Chapter 21. I Settle My Tab. It's funny how humans can wrap their minds around things and fit them into their version of reality. Chiron told me that long ago. As usual, I didn't appreciate his wisdom until much later. According to the LA News, the explosion at the Santa Monica Beach had been caused when a crazy kidnapper fired a shotgun at a police car. He accidentally hit a gas main that had ruptured during the earthquake. This crazy kidnapper, a.k.a. Aries, was the same man who had abducted me and two other adolescents in New York and brought us across the country on a 10-day odyssey of terror. Poor little Percy Jackson wasn't an international criminal after all. He'd caused a commotion on that Greyhound bus in New Jersey trying to get away from his captor. And afterward, witnesses would even swear they had seen the leather-clad man on the bus. Why didn't I remember before? The crazy man had caused the explosion in the St. Louis Arch. After all, no kid could have done that. A concerned waitress in Denver had seen the man threatening his abductees outside her diner, gotten a friend to take a photo, and notified the police. Finally, brave Percy Jackson, I was beginning to like this kid, had stolen a gun from his captor in Los Angeles and battled him, shotgun to rifle, on the beach. Police had arrived just in time. But in the spectacular explosion, five police cars had been destroyed and the captor had fled. No fatalities had occurred. Percy Jackson and his two friends were safely in police custody. The reporters fed us this whole story. We just nodded and acted tearful and exhausted, which wasn't hard, and played victimized kids for the cameras. All I want, I said, choking back my tears, is to see my loving stepfather again. Every time I saw him on TV, calling me a delinquent punk, I knew somehow we would be okay. And I know he'll want to reward each and every person in this beautiful city of Los Angeles with a free major appliance from his store. Here's the phone number. The police and reporters were so moved that they passed around the hat and raised money for three tickets on the next plane to New York. I knew there was no choice but to fly. I hoped Zeus would cut me some slack, considering the circumstances. But it was still hard to force myself on board the flight. Takeoff was a nightmare. Every spot of turbulence was scarier than a Greek monster. I didn't unclench my hands from the armrest until we touched down safely at LaGuardia. The local press was waiting for us outside security. But we managed to evade them thanks to Annabeth, who lured them away with her invisible Yankees cap, shouting, "They're over by the frozen yogurt! Come on!" Then rejoined us at the baggage claim. We split up at the taxi stand. I told Annabeth and Grover to get back to Half Blood Hill and tell Chiron what happened. They protested, and it was hard to let them go after all we'd been through, but I knew I had to do this last part of the quest by myself. If things went wrong, if the gods didn't believe me, I wanted Annabeth and Grover to tell Chiron the truth. I hopped into a taxi and headed into Manhattan. 30 minutes later, I walked into the lobby of the Empire State Building. I must have looked like a homeless kid with my tattered clothes and my scraped-up face. I hadn't slept in at least 24 hours. I went to the guard at the front desk and said, 600th floor. He was reading a huge book with a picture of a wizard on the front. I wasn't much into fantasy. But the book must have been good, because the guard took a while to look up. No such floor, kiddo. I need an audience with Zeus. He gave me a vacant smile. Sorry? You heard me. I was about to decide this guy was just a regular mortal, and I'd better run for it before he called the straitjacket patrol, when he said, No appointment, no audience. Lord Zeus doesn't see anyone unannounced. Oh, I think he'll make an exception. I slipped off my backpack and unzipped the top. The guard looked inside at the metal cylinder, not getting what it was for a few seconds. Then his face went pale. That isn't... Yes, it is, I promised. You want me to take it out and...
No, no!
He scrambled out of his seat, fumbled around his desk for a key card, then handed it to me.
Insert this into the security slot. Make sure nobody else is in the elevator with you.
I did as he told me. As soon as the elevator doors closed, I slipped the key into the slot. The card disappeared, and a new button appeared on the console, a red one that said 600. I pressed it and waited. And waited. Muzak played. Raindrops keep falling on my head. Finally, ding! The door slid open. I stepped out and almost had a heart attack. I was standing on a narrow stone walkway in the middle of the air. Below me was Manhattan, from the height of an airplane. In front of me, white marble steps wound up the spine of a cloud into the sky. My eyes followed the stairway to its end, where my brain just could not accept what I saw.
Look again, my brain said.
We're looking,
my eyes insisted.
It's really there.
From the top of the clouds rose the decapitated peak of a mountain, its summit covered with snow. Clinging to the mountainside were dozens of multi-leveled palaces, a city of mansions, all with white-columned porticos, gilded terraces, and bronze braziers glowing with a thousand flames. Roads wound crazily up to the peak, where the largest palace gleamed against the snow. Precariously perched gardens bloomed with olive trees and rose bushes. I could make out an open-air market filled with colorful tents, a stone amphitheater built on one side of the mountain, a hippodrome and a coliseum on the other. It was an ancient Greek city, except it wasn't in ruins. It was new and clean and colorful, the way Athens must have looked 2,500 years ago.
This place can't be here, I told myself.
The tip of a mountain hanging over New York City like a billion-ton asteroid? How could something like that be anchored above the Empire State Building, in plain sight of millions of people, and not get noticed? But here it was. And here I was. My trip through Olympus was a daze. I passed some giggling wood nymphs who threw olives at me from their garden. Hawkers in the market offered to sell me ambrosia on a stick, and a new shield, and a genuine glitter-weave replica of the Golden Fleece, as seen on Hephaestus TV. The nine muses were tuning their instruments for a concert in the park while a small crowd gathered, satyrs and naiads and a bunch of good-looking teenagers who might have been minor gods and goddesses. Nobody seemed worried about an impending civil war. In fact, everybody seemed in a festive mood. Several of them turned to watch me pass and whisper to themselves. I climbed the main road toward the big palace at the peak. It was a reverse copy of the palace in the underworld. There, everything had seemed black and bronze. Here, everything glittered in white and silver. I realized Hades must have built his palace to resemble this one. He wasn't welcomed in Olympus except on the winter solstice, so he'd built his own Olympus, underground. Despite my bad experience with him, I felt a little sorry for the guy. To be banished from this place really seemed unfair. It would have made anybody bitter. Steps led to a central courtyard. Past that, the throne room.
Room isn't really the right word. The place made Grand Central Station look like a broom closet. Massive columns rose to a domed ceiling, which was gilded with moving constellations.
12 thrones, built for beings the size of Hades, were arranged in an inverted U, just like the cabins at Camp Half-Blood. An enormous fire crackled in the central hearth pit. The thrones were empty, except for two at the ends. The head throne on the right and the one to its immediate left. I didn't have to be told who the two gods were sitting there, waiting for me to approach. I came toward them, my legs trembling. The gods were in giant human forms, as Hades had been, but I could barely look at them without feeling a tingle, as if my body were starting to burn. Zeus, the lord of the gods,
wore a dark blue pinstriped suit. He sat on a simple throne of solid platinum. He had a well-trimmed beard, marbled gray and black, like a storm cloud. His face was proud and handsome and grim, his eyes rainy gray. As I got nearer to him, the air crackled and smelled of ozone. The god sitting next to him was his brother, without a doubt. But he was dressed differently. He reminded me of a beachcomber from Key West. He wore leather sandals, khaki Bermuda shorts, a Tommy Bahama shirt with coconuts and parrots all over it. His skin was deeply tanned, his hands scarred like an old-time fisherman's. His hair was black, like mine. His face had that same brooding look that had always gotten me branded a rebel. But his eyes, sea-green like mine, were surrounded by sun crinkles that told me he smiled a lot, too. His throne was a deep-sea fisherman's chair. It was the simple swivel kind, with a black leather seat and a built-in holster for a fishing pole. Instead of a pole, the holster held a bronze trident, flickering with green light around the tips. The gods weren't moving or speaking, but there was a tension in the air, as if they'd just finished an argument. I approached the fisherman's throne and knelt at his feet. "Father." I dared not look up. My heart was racing. I could feel the energy emanating from the two gods. If I said the wrong thing, I had no doubt they could blast me into dust. To my left, Zeus spoke. "Should you not address the master of the house first, boy?" I kept my head down and waited. "Peace, brother," Poseidon finally said. His voice stirred my oldest memories, that warm glow I remembered as a baby, the sensation of this god's hand on my forehead. "The boy defers to his father. This is only right." "You still claim him, then?" Zeus asked, menacingly. "You claim this child, whom you sired against our sacred oath." "I have admitted my wrongdoing," Poseidon said. "Now I would hear him speak." "Wrongdoing?" A lump welled up in my throat. Was that all I was? A wrongdoing? The result of a god's mistake? "I have spared him once already," Zeus grumbled. "Daring to fly through my domain. Pah! I should have blasted him out of the sky for his impudence."
"And risk destroying your own master bolt?" Poseidon asked calmly. "Let us hear him out, brother."
Zeus grumbled some more. "I shall listen," he decided. "Then I shall make up my mind whether or not to cast this boy down from Olympus."
"Perseus," Poseidon said, "look at me." I did, and I wasn't sure what I saw in his face. There was no clear sign of love or approval, nothing to encourage me. It was like looking at the ocean. Some days you could tell what mood it was in. Most days, though, it was unreadable, mysterious. I got the feeling Poseidon really didn't know what to think of me. He didn't know whether he was happy to have me as a son or not. In a strange way, I was glad that Poseidon was so distant. If he tried to apologize or told me he loved me or even smiled, it would have felt fake, like a human dad making some lame excuse for not being around. I could live with that. After all, I wasn't sure about him yet either.
"Address Lord Zeus, boy," Poseidon told me. "Tell him your story." So I told Zeus everything, just as it had happened. I took out the metal cylinder, which began sparkling in the sky god's presence, and laid it at his feet. There was a long silence, broken only by the crackle of the hearth fire. Zeus opened his palm. The lightning bolt flew into it. As he closed his fist, the metallic points flared with electricity until he was holding what looked more like the classic thunderbolt, a 20-foot javelin of arcing, hissing energy that made the hairs on my scalp rise.
"I sense the boy tells the truth," Zeus muttered. "But that Ares would do such a thing, it is most unlike him."
"He is proud and impulsive," Poseidon said.
It runs in the family.
Lord? I asked.
They both said, yes.
Ares didn't act alone. Someone else, something else, came up with the idea. I described my dreams and the feeling I'd had on the beach, that momentary breath of evil that had seemed to stop the world and made Ares back off from killing me. In the dreams, I said, the voice told me to bring the bolt to the underworld. Ares hinted that he'd been having dreams too. I think he was being used, just as I was, to start a war.
Are you accusing Hades after all? Zeus asked.
No, I said. I mean, Lord Zeus, I've been in the presence of Hades. This feeling on the beach was different. It was the same thing I felt when I got close to that pit. That was the entrance to Tartarus, wasn't it? Something powerful and evil is stirring down there, something even older than the gods.
Poseidon and Zeus looked at each other. They had a quick, intense discussion in ancient Greek. I only caught the word, father.
Poseidon made some kind of gesture, but Zeus cut him off.
Poseidon tried to argue.
Zeus held up his hand angrily.
We will speak of this no more, Zeus said. I must go personally to purify this thunderbolt in the waters of Lemnos, to remove the human taint from its metal.
He rose and looked at me. His expression softened just a fraction of a degree.
You have done me a service, boy. Few heroes could have accomplished as much.
I had help, sir, I said. Grover Underwood and Annabeth J.
To show you my thanks, I shall spare your life. I do not trust you, Perseus Jackson. I do not like what your arrival means for the future of Olympus. But for the sake of peace in your family, I shall let you live.
Thank you, sir.
Do not presume to fly again. Do not let me find you here when I return. Otherwise you shall taste this bolt, and it shall be your last sensation.
Thunder shook the palace. With a blinding flash of lightning, Zeus was gone. I was alone in the throne room with my father.
Your uncle, Poseidon sighed, has always had a flair for dramatic exits. I think he would have done well as the god of theater.
An uncomfortable silence.
Sir, I said, what was in that pit?
Poseidon regarded me. Have you not guessed?
Cronus, I said, the king of the Titans.
Even in the throne room of Olympus, far away from Tartarus, the name Cronus darkened the room, made the hearth fire seem not quite so warm on my back.
Poseidon gripped his trident.
In the first war, Percy, Zeus cut our father Cronus into 1,000 pieces, just as Cronus had done to his own father, Uranus. Zeus cast Cronus' remains into the darkest pit of Tartarus. The Titan army was scattered, their mountain fortress on Etna destroyed, their monstrous allies driven to the farthest corners of the earth. And yet Titans cannot die, any more than we gods can. Whatever is left of Cronus is still alive in some hideous way, still conscious in his eternal pain, still hungering for power.
He's healing, I said. He's coming back.
Poseidon shook his head. From time to time over the eons, Cronus has stirred. He enters men's nightmares and breathes evil thoughts. He wakens restless monsters from the depths. But to suggest he could rise from the pit is another thing.
That's what he intends, Father. That's what he said.
Poseidon was silent for a long time.
Lord Zeus has closed the discussion on this matter. He will not allow talk of Cronus. You have completed your quest, child. That is all you need to do.
But...
I stopped myself. Arguing would do no good. It would very possibly anger the only god who I had on my side.
As you wish, Father.
A faint smile played on his lips.
Obedience does not come naturally to you, does it?
No, sir.
I must take some blame for that, I suppose.
The sea does not like to be restrained. He rose to his full height and took up his trident. Then he shimmered and became the size of a regular man, standing directly in front of me. "You must go, child. But first, know that your mother has returned." I stared at him, completely stunned. "My mother?"
"You will find her at home. Hades sent her when you recovered his helm. Even the Lord of Death pays his debts."
My heart was pounding. I couldn't believe it. "Do you... would you?"
I wanted to ask Poseidon if he would come with me to see her, but then I realized that was ridiculous. I imagined loading the god of the sea into a taxi and taking him to the Upper East Side. If he wanted to see my mom all these years, he would have. And there was Smelly Gabe to think about. Poseidon's eyes took on a little sadness.
"When you return home, Percy, you must make an important choice. You will find a package waiting in your room."
"A package?"
"You will understand it when you see it. No one can choose your path, Percy. You must decide." I nodded, though I didn't know what he meant.
"Your mother is a queen among women," Poseidon said wistfully. I had not met such a mortal woman in 1,000 years. "Still, I am sorry you were born, child. I have brought you a hero's fate, and a hero's fate is never happy. It is never anything but tragic."
I tried not to feel hurt. Here was my own dad telling me he was sorry I'd been born.
"I don't mind, Father."
"Not yet, perhaps," he said. "Not yet. But it was an unforgivable mistake on my part."
"I'll leave you then." I bowed, awkwardly. I won't bother you again."
I was 5 steps away when he called, "Perseus!" I turned. There was a different light in his eye, a fiery kind of pride.
"You did well, Perseus. Do not misunderstand me. Whatever else you do, know that you are mine. You are a true son of the sea god."
As I walked back through the city of the gods, conversation stopped. The muses paused their concert. People and satyrs and naiads all turned toward me, their faces filled with respect and gratitude, and as I passed, they knelt as if I were some kind of hero. 15 minutes later, still in a trance, I was back on the streets of Manhattan. I caught a taxi to my mom's apartment, rang the doorbell, and there she was, my beautiful mother, smelling of peppermint and licorice, the weariness of my worry evaporating from her face as soon as she saw me.
"Oh, Percy! Oh, thank goodness! Oh, my baby!"
She crushed the air right out of me. We stood in the hallway as she cried and ran her hands through my hair. I'll admit it, my eyes were a little misty, too. I was shaking. I was so relieved to see her. She told me she'd just appeared at the apartment that morning, scaring Gabe half out of his wits. She didn't remember anything since the Minotaur. She couldn't believe it when Gabe told her I was a wanted criminal, traveling across the country, blowing up national monuments. She'd been going out of her mind with worry all day because she hadn't heard the news. Gabe had forced her to go into work, saying she had a month's salary to make up and she'd better get started. I swallowed back my anger and told her my story. I tried to make it sound less scary than it had been, but that wasn't easy. I was just trying to get to the fight with Ares when Gabe's voice interrupted from the living room.
"Hey, Sally, that meatloaf done yet or what?"
She closed her eyes. "He isn't going to be happy to see you, Percy. The store got 500,000 phone calls today from Los Angeles. Something about free appliances?"
About that."
She managed a weak smile.
"Just don't make him angrier, all right? Come on."
In the month I'd been gone, the apartment had turned into Gabeland. Garbage was ankle deep on the carpet. The sofa had been reupholstered in beer cans. Dirty socks and underwear hung off the lampshades. Gabe and 3 of his big goony friends were playing poker at the table. When Gabe saw me, his cigar dropped out of his mouth.
His face got redder than lava.
You got nerve coming here, you little punk. I thought the police...
He's not a fugitive after all, Mom interjected. Isn't that wonderful, Gabe?
Gabe looked back and forth between us. He didn't seem to think my homecoming was so wonderful.
Bad enough. I had to give back your life insurance money, Sally,
he growled.
Get me the phone. I'll call the cops.
Gabe, no. He raised his eyebrows.
Did you just say no? You think I'm going to put up with this punk again? I can still press charges against him for ruining my Camaro.
But...
He raised his hand, and my mother flinched. For the first time, I realized something. Gabe had hit my mother. I didn't know when or how much, but I was sure he'd done it. Maybe it had been going on for years when I wasn't around. A balloon of anger started exploding in my chest. I came toward Gabe, instinctively taking my pen out of my pocket. He just laughed.
What, punk? You gonna write on me? You touch me, and you are going to jail forever. You understand?
Hey, Gabe, his friend Eddie interrupted. He's just a kid.
Gabe looked at him resentfully and mimicked a falsetto.
He's just a kid.
His other friends laughed like idiots.
I'll be nice to you, punk.
Gabe showed me his tobacco-stained teeth.
I'll give you 5 minutes to get your stuff and clear out. After that, I call the police.
Gabe,
my mother pleaded.
He ran away, Gabe told her. Let him stay gone.
I was itching to uncap Riptide. But even if I did, the blade wouldn't hurt humans. And Gabe, by the loosest definition, was human.
My mother took my arm.
Please, Percy, come on. We'll go to your room.
I let her pull me away, my hands still trembling with rage. My room had been completely filled with Gabe's junk. There were stacks of used car batteries, a rotting bouquet of sympathy flowers with a card from somebody who'd seen his Barbara Walters interview.
Gabe is just upset, honey, my mother told me. I'll talk to him later. I'm sure it'll work out.
Mom, it'll never work out. Not as long as Gabe's here. She wrung her hands nervously.
I'll take you to work with me for the rest of the summer. In the fall, maybe there's another boarding school.
Mom!
She lowered her eyes.
I'm trying, Percy. I just need some time.
A package appeared on my bed. At least I could have sworn it hadn't been there a moment before. It was a battered cardboard box, about the right size to fit a basketball. The address on the mailing slip was in my own handwriting. The Gods, Mount Olympus, 600th floor, Empire State Building, New York, New York, with best wishes, Percy Jackson. Over the top in black marker, in a man's clear, bold print, was the address to our apartment, with the words, Return to Sender. Suddenly, I understood what Poseidon had told me on Olympus. A package, a decision. Whatever else you do, know that you are mine. You are a true son of the sea god. I looked at my mother.
Mom, do you want Gabe gone?
Percy, it isn't that simple.
Mom, just tell me. That jerk has been hitting you. Do you want him gone or not? She hesitated, then nodded almost imperceptibly.
Yes, Percy, I do. And I'm still trying to get my courage up to tell him. But you can't do this for me. You can't solve my problems.
I looked at the box. I could solve her problem. I wanted to slice that package open, plop it on the poker table, and take out what was inside. I could start my very own statue garden right here in the living room. That's what a Greek hero would do in the stories, I thought. That's what Gabe deserves. But a hero's story always ended in tragedy. Poseidon had told me that. I remembered the underworld. I thought about Gabe's spirit drifting forever in the fields of Astrodel,
or condemned to some hideous torture behind the barbed wire of the fields of punishment, an eternal poker game, sitting up to his waist in boiling oil, listening to opera music. Did I have the right to send someone there? Even Gabe? A month ago, I wouldn't have hesitated. Now, I can do it, I told my mom. One look inside this box, and he'll never bother you again. She glanced at the package and seemed to understand immediately.
No, Percy, she said, stepping away. You can't.
Poseidon called you a queen, I told her. He said he hadn't met a woman like you in 1,000 years. Her cheeks flushed.
Percy.
You deserve better than this, Mom. You should go to a college, get your degree. You can write your novel. Meet a nice guy. Live in a nice house. You don't need to protect me anymore by staying with Gabe. Let me get rid of him. She wiped a tear off her cheek.
You sound so much like your father, she said. He offered to stop the tide for me once. He offered to build me a palace at the bottom of the sea. He thought he could solve all of my problems with a wave of his hand.
What's wrong with that? Her multicolor eyes seemed to search inside me.
I think you know, Percy. I think you're enough like me to understand. If my life is going to mean anything, I have to live it myself. I can't let a god take care of me. Or my son. I have to find the courage on my own. Your quest has reminded me of that.
We listened to the sound of poker chips and swearing, ESPN from the living room television. I'll leave the box, I said. If he threatens you. She looked pale, but she nodded.
Where will you go, Percy?
Half-Blood Hill.
For the summer or forever?
I guess that depends. We locked eyes, and I sensed that we had an agreement. We would see how things stood at the end of summer. She kissed my forehead.
You'll be a hero, Percy. You'll be the greatest of all.
I took one last look around my bedroom. I had a feeling I'd never see it again. Then I walked with my mother to the front door.
Leaving so soon, punk?
Gabe called after me.
Good riddance.
I had one last twinge of doubt. How could I turn down the perfect chance to take revenge on him? I was leaving here without saving my mother.
Hey, Sally, he yelled. What about that meatloaf, huh?
A steely look of anger flared in my mother's eyes, and I thought, just maybe, I was leaving her in good hands after all. Her own. The meatloaf is coming right up, dear, she told Gabe.
Meatloaf surprise.
She looked at me and winked. The last thing I saw as the door swung closed was my mother staring at Gabe as if she was contemplating how he would look as a garden statue. Chapter 22. The Prophecy Comes True. We were the first heroes to return alive to Half-Blood Hill since Luke, so of course everybody treated us as if we'd won some reality TV contest. According to camp tradition, we wore laurel wreaths to a big feast prepared in our honor, and then led a procession down to the bonfire, where we got to burn the burial shrouds of cabins that they had made for us in our absence. Annabeth's shroud was so beautiful, gray silk with embroidered owls. I told her it seemed a shame not to bury her in it. She punched me and told me to shut up. Being the son of Poseidon, I hadn't had any cabin mates, so the Ares cabin had volunteered to make my shroud. They'd taken an old bedsheet and painted smiley faces with X'd out eyes around the borders, and the word loser painted really big in the middle. It was fun to burn. As Apollo's cabin led the sing-along and passed out s'mores, I was surrounded by my old Hermes cabin mates, Annabeth's friends from Athena, and Grover's Satyr buddies, who were admiring the brand new searcher's license he'd received from the Council of Cloven Elders. The Council had called Grover's performance on the quest brave to the point of indigestion, horns and whiskers above anything we've seen in the past.
The only ones not in a party mood were Clarice and her cabin mates, whose poisonous looks told me they'd never forgive me for the disgrace of their dad. That was okay with me. Even Dionysus' welcome home speech wasn't enough to dampen my spirits.
Yes, yes, so the little brat didn't get himself killed, and now we'll have an even bigger head. Well, huzzah for that! In other announcements, there will be no canoe races this Saturday.
I moved back into Cabin 3, but it didn't feel so lonely anymore. I had my friends to train with during the day. At night, I lay awake and listened to the sea, knowing my father was out there. Maybe he wasn't quite sure about me yet. Maybe he hadn't even wanted me born. But he was watching, and so far, he was proud of what I'd done. As for my mother, she had a chance at a new life. Her letter arrived a week after I got back to camp. She told me Gabe had left mysteriously. Disappeared off the face of the planet, in fact. She'd reported him missing to the police. But she had a funny feeling they would never find him. On a completely unrelated subject, she sold her first life-size concrete sculpture entitled The Poker Player to a collector through an art gallery in Soho. She'd gotten so much money for it, she put a deposit down on a new apartment and made a payment on her first semester's tuition at NYU. The Soho gallery was clamoring for more of her work, which she called a huge step forward in super ugly neorealism. "But don't worry," my mom wrote. "I'm done with sculpture. I've disposed of that box of tools you left me. It's time for me to turn to writing." At the bottom, she wrote a P.S. "Percy, I found a good private school here in the city. I've put a deposit down to hold you a spot in case you want to enroll for 7th grade. You could live at home, but if you want to go year-round at Half-Blood Hill, I'll understand." I folded the note carefully and set it on my bedside table. Every night before I went to sleep, I read it again, and I tried to decide how to answer her. On the 4th of July, the whole camp gathered at the beach for a fireworks display by Cabin 9. Being Hephaestus's kids, they weren't going to settle for a few lame red, white, and blue explosions. They'd anchored a barge offshore and loaded it with rockets the size of Patriot missiles. According to Annabeth, who'd seen the show before, the blasts would be sequenced so tightly they'd look like frames of animation across the sky. The finale was supposed to be a couple of 100-foot-tall Spartan warriors who would crackle to life above the ocean, fight a battle, and then explode into a million colors. As Annabeth and I were spreading a picnic blanket, Grover showed up to tell us goodbye. He was dressed in his usual jeans and T-shirt and sneakers, but in the last few weeks he'd started to look older, almost high school age. His goatee had gotten thicker. He'd put on weight. His horns had grown at least an inch, so he now had to wear his Rasta cap all of the time to pass as human.
"I'm off," he said. "I just came to say, well, you know."
I tried to feel happy for him. After all, it wasn't every day a satyr got permission to go look for the great god Pan. But it was hard saying goodbye. I'd only known Grover a year, yet he was my oldest friend. Annabeth gave him a hug. She told him to keep his fake feet on. I asked him where he was going to search first.
"Kind of a secret," he said, looking embarrassed. "I wish you could come with me, guys. But humans and Pan..."
"We understand," Annabeth said. "You got enough tin cans for the trip?"
"Yeah."
"And you remembered your reed pipes?"
"Jeez, Annabeth," he grumbled. "You're like an old mama goat."
But he didn't really sound annoyed. He gripped his walking stick and slung a backpack over his shoulder. He looked like any hitchhiker you might see on an American highway. Nothing like the little runty boy I used to defend from bullies at Yancey Academy.
"Well," he said, "wish me luck."
He gave Annabeth another hug. He clapped me on the shoulder, then headed back through the dunes. Fireworks exploded to life overhead.
Hercules killing the Nemean lion, Artemis chasing the boar, George Washington, who, by the way, was a son of Athena, crossing the Delaware. "Hey, Grover," I called. He turned at the edge of the woods. "Wherever you're going, I hope they make good enchiladas." Grover grinned, and then he was gone, the trees closing around him.
"We'll see him again," Annabeth said.
I tried to believe it. The fact that no searcher had ever come back in 2,000 years, well, I decided not to think about it. Grover would be the first. He had to be. July passed. I spent my days devising new strategies for capture the flag and making alliances with the other cabins to keep the banner out of Ari's hands. I got to the top of the climbing wall for the first time without getting scorched by lava. From time to time, I'd walk past the big house, glance up at the attic window, and think about the oracle. I tried to convince myself that its prophecy had come to completion.
"You shall go west and face the god who has turned."
Been there, done that. Even though the traitor god had turned out to be Ares, rather than Hades.
"You shall find what was stolen, and see it safe returned."
Check. One master bolt delivered. One helm of darkness back on Hades' oily head.
"You shall be betrayed by one who calls you a friend."
This line still bothered me. Ares had pretended to be my friend, then betrayed me. That must be what the oracle meant.
"And you shall fail to save what matters most in the end."
I had failed to save my mom, but only because I'd let her save herself. I knew that was the right thing. So why was I still uneasy? The last night of the summer session came all too quickly. The campers had one last meal together. We burned part of our dinner for the gods. At the bonfire, the senior counselors awarded the end-of-summer beads. I got my own leather necklace, and when I saw the bead for my first summer, I was glad the firelight covered my blushing. The design was pitch black, with a sea-green trident shimmering in the center.
"The choice was unanimous," Luke announced. "This bead commemorates the first son of the sea god at this camp, and the quest he undertook into the deepest part of the underworld to stop a war." The entire camp got to their feet and cheered. Even Ari's cabin felt obliged to stand. Athena's cabin steered Annabeth to the front so she could share in the applause. I'm not sure I'd ever felt as happy or as sad as I did at that moment. I'd finally found a family, people who cared about me, and thought I'd done something right. In the morning, most of them would be leaving for the year. The next morning, I found a form letter at my bedside table. I knew Dionysus must have filled it out because he stubbornly insisted on getting my name wrong.
"Dear Peter Johnson, if you intend to stay at Camp Half-Blood year-round, you must inform the big house by noon today. If you do not announce your intentions, we will assume you have vacated your cabin or died a horrible death. Cleaning harpies will begin work at sundown. They will be authorized to eat any unregistered campers. All personal articles left behind will be incinerated in the lava pit. Have a nice day. Mr. D. Dionysus, Camp Director, Olympian Council Number 12. That's another thing about ADHD. Deadlines just aren't real to me until I'm staring one in the face. Summer was over, and I still hadn't answered my mother or the camp about whether I'd be staying. Now I only had a few hours to decide. The decision should have been an easy one. I mean, 9 months of hero training or 9 months of sitting in a classroom. Duh. But there was my mom to consider. For the first time, I had the chance to live with her for a whole year without Gabe. I had a chance to be at home and knock around the city in my free time. I remembered what Annabeth had said so long ago in our quest.
The real world is where the monsters are. That's where you learn whether you're any good or not.
I thought about the fate of Thalia, daughter of Zeus. I wondered how many monsters would attack me if I left Half-Blood Hill. If I stayed in one place for a whole school year, without Chiron or my friends around me to help, would my mother and I even survive until next summer? That was assuming the spelling tests and the 5-paragraph essays didn't kill me. I decided I'd go down to the arena and do some sword practice. Maybe that would clear my head. The campgrounds were mostly deserted, shimmering in the August heat. All the campers were in their cabins packing up, or running around with brooms and mops, getting ready for final inspection. Argus was helping some of the Aphrodite kids haul their Gucci suitcases and makeup kits over the hill, where the camp shuttle bus would be waiting to take them to the airport. "Don't think about leaving yet," I told myself. "Just train." I got to the Swordfighters Arena and found that Luke had had the same idea. His gym bag was plopped at the edge of the stage. He was working solo, wailing on battle dummies with a sword I'd never seen before. It must have been a regular steel blade, because he was slashing the dummies' heads right off, stabbing through their staw-stuffed guts. His orange counselor shirt was dripping with sweat. His expression was so intense, his life might have really been in danger. I watched, fascinated, as he disemboweled the whole row of dummies, hacking off limbs and basically reducing them to a pile of straw and armor. They were only dummies, but still, I couldn't help being awed by Luke's skill. The guy was an incredible fighter. It made me wonder again how he possibly could have failed at his quest. Finally, he saw me and stopped mid-swing. "Percy!" Sorry, I said, embarrassed. "It's okay," he said, lowering his sword. "Just doing some last-minute practice. Those dummies won't be bothering anybody anymore." Luke shrugged. "We build new ones every summer." Now that his sword wasn't swirling around, I could see something odd about it. The blade was 2 different types of metal. One edge bronze, the other steel. Luke noticed me looking at it. "Oh, this. New toy. This is Backbiter." "Backbiter?" Luke turned the blade in the light so it glinted wickedly. "One side is celestial bronze. The other is tempered steel. Works on mortals and immortals. Both." I thought about what Chiron had told me when I started my quest, that a hero should never harm mortals unless absolutely necessary. I didn't know they could make weapons like that. "They probably can't," Luke agreed. "It's one of a kind." He gave me a tiny smile, then slid the sword into its scabbard. "Listen, I was going to come looking for you. What do you say we go down to the woods one last time? Look for something to fight." I don't know why I hesitated. I should have felt relieved that Luke was being so friendly. Ever since I'd gotten back from the quest, he'd been acting a little distant. I was afraid he might resent me for all the attention I'd gotten. "You think it's a good idea?" I asked. "Aw, come on." He rummaged in his gym bag and pulled out a 6-pack of Cokes. "Drinks are on me." I stared at the Cokes, wondering where the heck he'd gotten them. There were no regular mortal sodas at the camp store. No way to smuggle them in unless you talked to a satyr, maybe. Of course, the magic dinner goblets would fill anything you want. It just didn't taste the same as real Coke, straight out of the can. "Sugar and caffeine." My willpower crumbled. "Sure," I decided. "Why not?" We walked down to the woods and kicked around for some kind of monster to fight, but it was too hot. All the monsters with any sense must have been taking siestas in their nice cool caves. We found a shady spot by the creek where I'd broken Clarice's spear during my first capture of the flag game. We sat on a big rock, drank our Cokes, and watched the sunlight in the woods. After a while, Luke said, "You miss being on a quest? With monsters attacking me every 3 feet? Are you kidding?" Luke raised an eyebrow. "Yeah, I miss it," I admitted. "You?" A shadow passed over his face. I was used to hearing from the girls how good-looking Luke was, but at that moment he looked weary and angry and not at all handsome. His blonde hair was gray in the sunlight. The scar on his face looked deeper than usual. I could imagine him as an old man.
"I've lived at Half-Blood year-round since I was 14, he told me. "Ever since Thalia, well, you know. I trained and trained and trained. I never got to be a normal teenager out there in the real world. Then they threw me one quest, and when I came back, it was like, okay, ride's over. Have a nice life."
He crumbled his Coke can and threw it into the creek, which really shocked me. One of the first things you'll learn at Camp Half-Blood is don't litter. You'll hear from the nymphs and the naiads. They'll get even. You'll crawl into bed one night and find your sheets filled with centipedes and mud.
The heck with laurel wreaths, Luke said. I'm not going to end up like those dusty trophies in the big house attic.
You make it sound like you're leaving.
Luke gave me a twisted smile. Oh, I'm leaving, all right, Percy. I brought you down here to say goodbye.
He snapped his fingers. A small fire burned a hole in the ground at my feet. Out crawled something glistening black, about the size of my hand. A scorpion. I started to go for my pen.
I wouldn't, Luke cautioned. Pit scorpions can jump up to 15 feet. Its stinger can pierce right through your clothes. You'll be dead in 60 seconds.
Luke, what?
Then it hit me.
You will be betrayed by one who calls you a friend.
You! I said. He stood calmly and brushed off his jeans. The scorpion paid him no attention. It kept its beady black eyes on me, clamping its pincers as it crawled onto my shoe.
I saw a lot out there in the world, Percy, Luke said. Didn't you feel it? The darkness gathering, the monsters growing stronger. Didn't you realize how useless it all is? All the heroics, being pawns of the gods. They should have been overthrown thousands of years ago, but they've hung on, thanks to us half-bloods. I couldn't believe this was happening. Luke, you're talking about our parents, I said.
He laughed. That's supposed to make me love them? Their precious Western civilization is a disease. Percy, it's killing the world. The only way to stop it is to burn it to the ground. Start over with something more honest.
You're as crazy as Ares.
His eyes flared. Ares is a fool. He never realized the true master he was serving. If I had time, Percy, I could explain. But I'm afraid you won't live that long.
The scorpion crawled onto my pant leg.
There had to be a way out of this. I needed time to think.
Cronus, I said. That's who you serve.
The air got colder. You should be careful with names, Percy, Luke warned.
Cronus got you to steal the master bolt and the helm. He spoke to you in your dreams.
Luke's eyes twitched. He spoke to you too, Percy. You should have listened.
He's brainwashing you, Luke.
You're wrong. He showed me that my talents are being wasted. You know what my quest was 2 years ago, Percy. My father, Hermes, wanted me to steal a golden apple from the Garden of Hesperides and to return it to Olympus. After all the training I'd done, that was the best he could think up.
That's not an easy quest, I said. Hercules did it.
Exactly, Luke said. Where's the glory in repeating what others have done? All the gods know how to do is replay their past. My heart wasn't in it. The dragon in the garden gave me this. He pointed angrily at his scar. And when I came back, all I got was pity. I wanted to pull Olympus down stone by stone right then. But I bided my time. I began to dream of Cronus. He convinced me to steal something worthwhile, something no hero had ever had the courage to take. When we went on that winter solstice field trip while the other campers were asleep,
I snuck into the throne room and took Zeus's master bolt right from his chair. Hades' helm of darkness, too. You wouldn't believe how easy it was. The Olympians are so arrogant. They never dreamed somebody would dare steal from them. Their security is horrible. I was halfway across New Jersey before I heard the storms rumbling, and I knew they'd discovered my theft. The scorpion was sitting on my knee now, staring at me with its glittering eyes. I tried to keep my voice level. So why didn't you bring the items to Cronus? Luke's smile wavered. I got overconfident. Zeus sent out his sons and daughters to find the stolen bolt. Artemis, Apollo, my father Hermes. But it was Ares who caught me. I could have beaten him, but I wasn't careful enough. He disarmed me, took the items of power, threatened to return them to Olympus, and burn me alive. Then, Cronus's voice came to me and told me what to say. I put the idea in Ares' head about a great war between the gods. I said all he had to do was hide the items for a while and watch the others fight. Ares got a wicked gleam in his eye. I knew he was hooked. He let me go, and I returned to Olympus before anybody noticed my absence. Luke drew his new sword. He ran his thumb down the flat of the blade, as if he were hypnotized by its beauty. Afterward, the Lord of the Titans, he punished me with nightmares. I swore not to fail again. Back at Camp Half-Blood, in my dreams, I was told that a second hero would arrive, one who could be tricked into taking the bolt and the helm the rest of the way, from Ares down to Tartarus. You summoned the Hellhound that night in the forest. We had to make Chiron think the camp wasn't safe for you, so he would start you on your quest. We had to confirm his fears that Hades was after you, and it worked. The flying shoes were cursed, I said. They were supposed to drag me and the backpack into Tartarus. And they would have, if you'd been wearing them. But you gave them to the Satyr, which wasn't part of the plan. Grover messes up everything he touches. He even confused the curse. Luke looked upon the scorpion, which was now sitting on my thigh. You should have died in Tartarus, Percy. But don't worry. I'll leave you with my little friend to set things right. Thalia gave up her life to save you, I said, gritting my teeth. And this is how you repay her? Don't speak of Thalia, he shouted. The gods let her die. That's one of the many things they will pay for. You're being used, Luke. You and Ares both. Don't listen to Cronus. I've been used? Luke's voice turned shrill. Look at yourself. What has your dad ever done for you? Cronus will rise. You've only delayed his plans. He will cast the Olympians into Tartarus and drive humanity back to their caves. All except the strongest, the ones who serve him. Call off the bug, I said. If you're so strong, fight me yourself. Luke smiled. Nice try, Percy. But I'm not Ares. You can't bait me. My lord is waiting, and he's got plenty of quests for me to undertake. Luke! Goodbye, Percy. There is a new golden age coming. You won't be part of it. He slashed his sword in an arc and disappeared in a ripple of darkness. The scorpion lunged. I swatted it away with my hand and uncapped my sword. The thing jumped at me, and I cut it in half in midair. I was about to congratulate myself until I looked down at my hand. My palm had a huge red welt, oozing and smoking with yellow guck. The thing had gotten me after all. My ears pounded. My vision went foggy. The water, I thought, it healed me before. I stumbled to the creek and submerged my hand, but nothing seemed to happen. The poison was too strong. My vision was getting dark. I could barely stand up. 60 seconds, Luke had told me. I had to get back to camp. If I collapsed out here, my body would be dinner for some monster. Nobody would ever know what had happened. My legs felt like lead. My forehead was burning. I stumbled toward camp,
and the nymphs stirred from their trees.
Help!
I croaked.
Please!
Two of them took my arms, pulling me along. I remember making it to the clearing, a counselor shouting for help, a centaur blowing a conch horn. Then everything went black. I woke with a drinking straw in my mouth. I was sipping something that tasted like liquid chocolate chip cookies. Nectar. I opened my eyes. I was propped up in bed in the sick room of the big house, my right hand bandaged like a club. Argus stood guard in the corner. Annabeth sat next to me, holding my nectar glass and dabbing a washcloth on my forehead.
"Here we are again,"
I said.
"You idiot,"
Annabeth said, which is how I knew she would be overjoyed to see me conscious.
"You were green and turning gray when we found you. If it wasn't for Chiron's healing."
"Now, now," Chiron's voice said. "Percy's constitution deserves some credit." He was sitting near the foot of my bed in human form, which is why I hadn't noticed him yet. His lower half was magically compacted into the wheelchair, his upper half dressed in a coat and tie. He smiled, but his face looked weary and pale, the way it did when he'd been up all night grading Latin papers.
"How are you feeling?"
he asked. "Like my insides have been frozen, then microwaved." "Apt, considering that was pit scorpion venom. Now you must tell me, if you can, exactly what happened?"
Between sips of nectar, I told him the story. The room was quiet for a long time.
"I can't believe that, Luke!"
Annabeth's voice faltered. Her expression turned angry and sad.
"Yes, yes, I can't believe it. May the gods curse him. He was never the same after his quest."
"This must be reported to Olympus," Chiron muttered. "I will go at once."
"Luke is out there right now," I said.
"I have to go after him."
Chiron shook his head. "No, Percy. The gods."
"Won't even talk to Cronus," I snapped. "Zeus declared the matter closed."
"Percy, I know this is hard, but you must not rush out for vengeance. You aren't ready." I didn't like it, but part of me suspected Chiron was right. One look at my hand, and I knew I wasn't going to be sword fighting anytime soon.
"Chiron, your prophecy from the Oracle, it was about Cronus, wasn't it? Was I in it? And Annabeth?"
Chiron glanced nervously at the ceiling.
"Percy, it isn't my place." "You've been ordered not to talk to me about it, haven't you?"
His eyes were sympathetic, but sad.
"You will be a great hero, child. I will do my best to prepare you. But if I'm right about the path ahead of you..." Thunder boomed overhead, rattling the windows.
"All right," Chiron shouted. "Fine."
He sighed in frustration. "The gods have their reasons, Percy. Knowing too much of your future is never a good thing."
"We can't just sit back and do nothing," I said.
"We will not sit back," Chiron promised. "But you must be careful. Cronus wants you to come unraveled. He wants your life disrupted, your thoughts clouded with fear and anger. Do not give him what he wants. Train patiently. Your time will come."
"Assuming that I live that long."
Chiron put his hand on my ankle. "You'll have to trust me, Percy. You will live. But first, you must decide your path for the coming year. I cannot tell you the right choice."
I got the feeling that he had a very definite opinion, and it was taking all his willpower not to advise me.
"But you must decide whether to stay at Camp Half-Blood year-round, or return to the mortal world for 7th grade and be a summer camper. Think on that. When I get back from Olympus, you must tell me your decision."
I wanted to protest. I wanted to ask him more questions. But his expression told me
There could be no more discussion. He had said as much as he could. "I'll be back as soon as I can," Chiron promised. "Argus will watch over you." He glanced at Annabeth. "Oh, and my dear, whenever you're ready, they're here." "Who's here?" I asked. Nobody answered. Chiron rolled himself out of the room. I heard the wheels of his chair clunk carefully down the front steps, two at a time. Annabeth studied the ice in my drink. "What's wrong?" I asked her.
"Nothing."
She set the glass on the table.
"I just took your advice about something. You need anything?"
"Yeah. Help me up. I want to go outside."
"Percy, that isn't a good idea."
I slid my legs out of bed. Annabeth caught me before I could crumble to the floor. A wave of nausea rolled over me. Annabeth said,
"I told you."
"I'm fine," I insisted. I didn't want to lie in bed like an invalid while Luke was out there planning to destroy the Western world. I managed a step forward, then another, still leaning heavily on Annabeth. Argus followed us outside, but he kept his distance. By the time we reached the porch, my face was beaded with sweat. My stomach had twisted into knots, but I had managed to make it all the way to the railing. It was dusk. The camp looked completely deserted. The cabins were dark, and the volleyball pit silent. No canoes cut the surface of the lake. Beyond the woods and the strawberry fields, the Long Island Sound glittered in the last light of the sun.
"What are you going to do?"
Annabeth asked me.
"I don't know."
I told her I got the feeling Chiron wanted me to stay year-round, to put in more individual training time. But I wasn't sure that's what I wanted. I admitted I'd feel bad about leaving her alone, though, with only Carice for company.
Annabeth pursed her lips, then said quietly, "I'm going home for the year, Percy."
I stared at her. "You mean to your dad's?" She pointed toward the crest of Half-Blood Hill. Next to Thalia's pine tree, at the very edge of the camp's magical boundaries, the family stood silhouetted. Two little children, a woman, and a tall man with blonde hair. They seemed to be waiting. The man was holding a backpack that looked like the one Annabeth had gotten from Waterland in Denver.
"I wrote him a letter when we got back," Annabeth said. "Just like you suggested. I told him I was sorry. I'd come home for the school year if he still wanted me. He wrote back immediately. We decided to give it another try."
"That took guts." She pursed her lips.
"You won't try anything stupid during the school year, will you? At least, not without sending me an Iris message."
I managed to smile. "I won't go looking for trouble. I usually don't have to."
"When I get back next summer," she said, "we'll hunt down Luke. We'll ask for a quest. But if we don't get approval, we'll sneak off and do it anyway. Agreed?"
"Sounds like a plan worthy of Athena." She held out her hand. I shook it.
"Take care, seaweed brain,"
Annabeth told me.
"Keep your eyes open."
"You too, wise girl." I watched her walk up the hill to join her family. She gave her father an awkward hug and looked back at the valley one last time. She touched Thalia's pine tree, then allowed herself to be led over the crest and into the mortal world. For the first time at camp, I felt truly alone. I looked out at Long Island Sound, and I remembered my father saying, "The sea does not like to be restrained." I made my decision. I wondered if Poseidon were watching. Would he approve of my choice? "I'll be back next summer," I promised him. "I'll survive until then. After all, I am your son." I asked Argus to take me down to Cabin 3 so I could pack my bags for home. Acknowledgements. Without the assistance of numerous valiant helpers, I would have been slain by monsters many times over as I endeavored to bring this story to print. Thanks to my elder son, Haley Michael, who heard the first story. My younger son, Patrick John, who, at the age of 6, is the level-headed one in the family. And my wife, Becky, who puts up with my many long hours at Camp Half-Blood. Thanks also to my cadre of middle school beta testers. Travis Stoll, clever and quick as Hermes. C.C. Kellogg, beloved as Athena. Allison Bauer, clear-eyed as Artemis the Huntress. And Mrs. Margaret Floyd, the wise and kindly seer of middle school English. My appreciation also to Professor Egbert J. Baker, classicist extraordinaire. Nancy Galt, agent cum summa laude. Jonathan Burnham, Jennifer Besser, and Sarah Hughes for believing in Percy.